We can contrast this rather strongly with the style that seems to be typical of the Linux world, which was originated by Linus himself, in which you release really early, you release really, really often, and you listen to your beta testers a lot. I mean, I'm sure all of you know that during the periods of the most intense kernel development, Linus was literally doing a release once a day. And I started thinking about what this meant. It seemed to me that the difference between the cathedral style and what I call the bazaar style, because the Linux world is like a great babbling bazaar of many voices, the difference between these two styles seems to me to depend on different assumptions about the nature of the debugging process. Okay? In the cathedral style, it's all based on the assumption that bugs are deep, tricky, insidious phenomena that require the full-time attention of experts to find them all. Only, well, as we all know, they don't. On the other hand, the bazaar style, the Linux world style, only makes sense if you assume that a whole bunch of half-amateur programmers just sort of randomly bashing on the code is sufficient to find all the bugs. And having gotten this far, I realized that there were certain things that were very important to Linus's development style. One is that he released very often. Another thing is that in the Linux world, the way Linus does things, when one of your users finds a bug or suggests a feature which goes in or otherwise does something good, well, you reward the user. Okay? The way you reward the user is by saying nice things about the user on your mailing list. or just the immediate reward of putting out a release every day so that user can see, well, you know, when I fix something, I don't have to wait to see my change for 6 months. Instead, I get to see it the next day. Ooh, instant gratification, I love it. So it seemed clear to me that what Linus was doing was, instead of taking the classical approach, which says that you have to expose as few bugs to the users as possible, because when users see bugs, they will get disgusted and go away and your project will die. Instead, Linus was deliberately ignoring that risk. His approach instead was to say, what can I do that will maximize the number of developer hours that are thrown at looking at this project? You see what I'm getting at? Everything he did, building huge lists of beta testers and inviting people to come play with his stuff when it was in a very immature state, and constantly taking improvements from other people and putting them in so that people could see the effect of their improvements right away, it was all designed to hook in everybody's egos. So everybody involved in the project would get immediate ego gratification as often as possible from seeing how it was improving. And, once I got this far, I realized, well, we have empirical evidence that even for something as complicated as an operating system kernel, the bazaar style works a whole lot better than the cathedral style. What does this mean? Well, what it means is, I think that we've discovered a positive scaling law of software engineering. This in itself is pretty remarkable, because all the scaling laws we know in software engineering up to now are negative. The bigger things get, the more fragile they get. What we seem to have discovered here is what I have dubbed Linus's law, and I actually sent a draft of this paper to Linus, and I bounced this concept off him, and he more or less endorsed it. The informal way of stating it is, given a sufficient number of beta testers, that's the formal way. The informal way of stating it is, given enough eyeballs, all bugs are shallow. Or more formally, given a sufficiently large pool of beta testers, users, and co-developers, every bug will be obvious to someone. It won't be the same someone in any two adjacent cases. But the more developers you have, the more beta testers you have, it increases the possibility that there will be someone out there who will look at the symptoms of any given bug and go, oh, that's obvious. I know what's doing that. And they'll feed that back to you, and you'll fix it, and you'll look like a hero. I think this is really important because it means that we now know a way to get high quality, reliable software that doesn't depend on any one person being brilliant. It's a little scary if you think about it. Well, let's look at some other consequences and behaviors. Well, now let me talk about. Let me talk about a real-world example, I guess, is what I should do next. I attempted to run the FetchMail project in accordance with this principle, and if you think I'm using two different names for the software, you're right. Its name changed. There was a point at which the name changed. I went out looking. I got involved in this project because I was in the typical situation of a lot of Linux users nowadays, which is that I'm hooked up to the internet via an internet service provider, and the connection is PPP or SLIP, which means I don't have a full-time mail connection, which means I have to have my mail delivered on a mail server somewhere, and then I have to mine it out of there with POP3 or IMAP. Do enough people understand this that I don't have to explain it? Is anybody really puzzled by this? Oh, what's your question? Okay. Just him? Oh, God. I'm in trouble. Okay, so the basic problem that these protocols are designed to solve is what is the model that SMTP and internet mail transmission assumes that both the source and the target machines are up all the time, are connected to the network all the time. So it's a push model. When you send mail, your user agent passes it to send mail or some equivalent, I'll just say send mail, and SendMail opens up an SMTP connection to the target machine, and it opens up a connection to port 25, and a listener on port 25 has an SMTP conversation with the sending machine and picks up the mail and delivers it locally. Well, this works very well, except maybe your listener isn't there if your machine is intermittently off the net. So what you need to do to solve that problem is you need to have your mail delivered to a mail server, and then your machine, your personal machine, has to go to that mail server and pull the mail over instead of having it pushed over. Your personal machine calls in, does a protocol transaction with a post office protocol server, pulls the mail over the wire, and delivers it locally, and you're done. And so I needed a POP client. And I went out on the internet and I found 9 of them, and 7 of them were complete crap. And this was distressing because it seemed like a problem that should have been solved before. But I looked at the 2 that were not crap, and I did substantial work on one of them. And then I found the other, which seemed to have source, which was in much better shape, and that was POP client. And so I talked to the person who was maintaining POP client. It turned out he was no longer interested in maintaining it, so I could take it over. I started working on it. The reason I'm explaining all this is because I want to explain how the most important idea in the project actually came from somebody else. Okay, the most important idea in FetchMail was that instead of going through lots of kludges like appending the mail directly to your mailbox or feeding the mail to procmail, one of my beta testers pointed out early in the project that you could have a delivery mode that fooled the local send mail into thinking it was a remote send mail. It would call up port 25 on your machine while it was collecting the mail, and it would have an SMTP conversation with your local send mail while it was picking up the mail off the mail server, and each message would get passed as an SMTP transaction. Some of you may not be able to follow all these technical details, but the point of doing things this way is that Pop and IMAP mail now become completely indistinguishable from ordinary mail, and all your normal forwarding, filtering, and aliasing mechanisms just work with no more fuss. This is very good. But I didn't originate this idea. This idea came to me because I had decided to run my project in what I thought was Linus Torvalds' style, the bizarre style, and that involved adding as many beta testers to my list as I could and encouraging them to feedback features and fixes. Basically, the way it worked is anytime somebody sent me mail about the program, I would put them on my beta list, and they'd stay on there until they asked to be taken off. The other part of the strategy was I was chatty with my beta testers. You know, I didn't just send out release announcements. I would, you know, when I had a technical problem I wanted to solve or a design choice I had to make, I would send out a notice to the list saying, well, gee, this particular problem's come up. What do you people think I should do about it? What seems like the right thing? I've got several alternatives, and I'm going to have to decide among them. I'm going to make the decision, but what do you people think? And so what I was doing was the same thing that Linus seems to do a lot, which is encourage people to feel a deep sense of involvement with the whole project. And it worked pretty well. And the big payoff came when one of my beta testers, a man named Terry Hochheiser, sent me this suggestion about SMTP forwarding. And I looked at it and I went, oh my God, that's the right thing. And that single design concept, more than anything else that I did, is what made FetchMail really successful, and it's really successful now. And this leads me straight into an important feature about the bazaar model, which is that it's not so important that somebody developing this way be a really brilliant designer. It's not all that important that you be able to originate wonderful ideas. I mean, I like to think that I can, and it certainly helps if you can. But the more important talent is to be able to recognize good ideas from other people. Now, we noticed that Linus Torvalds is very, very good at this. No dispute about that, right? Okay. I don't think I'm as good at it as he is, but I did okay, which is why the project succeeded. And, you know, there's an interesting thing about developing this way. You can take lots of ideas from other people, and you can be incredibly modest and self-deprecating and say, other people did all the work, and everybody will think you're a genius anyway. I mean, we all see how well this worked for Linus. What Linus Torvalds did was he discovered how to recruit other people and use their brains as amplifiers and make them feel good about it. And, of course, the internet was very important in this. I don't think it's at all coincidence that the gestation period, the birth of Linux, coincides with the period in which there was a popular explosion of interest in the internet, and internet access finally became available to a great many people very cheap. What's going on here, I think, is that Linus Torvalds was the first person to discover, rather unconsciously, but he did discover, how to play by the new rules that the internet made possible. Okay? And my job with this paper is to make you all conscious about it. Because the thing is, as a community and as individuals, we've sort of stumbled into this collective development style, this brain amplifier technique. Linus does it very well. Okay, some of us have half learned how to unconsciously how to do it on our own. And I'm here to tell you that you can do it consciously, and it works even better. Let me page through here for some more bullet points here, consult my external memory. Let's talk about complexity analysis. I started out by saying that a lot of the negative scaling laws in software engineering are based on the fact that your complexity costs scale as n squared, where n is the number of programmers. An interesting thing to notice here is when you the communication pattern in a project like this is not a whole bunch of programmers talking to each other. It's a whole bunch of programmers talking to one guy at the center. So it's sort of star-shaped. Okay? The result is that you get the benefits of having a lot more programmer hours thrown at your problem without incurring that n squared complexity cost, because they're all talking to the one guy. And as long as he's got enough bandwidth to coordinate everything, you're okay. Of course, you can have bandwidth failures, and this has been known to happen. But another thing I want to point out is the effect of recruiting a lot of beta testers is not just quantitative. It's not just a matter of a bunch of interchangeable programmer hours being thrown at your problem. The effect is also qualitative. As I said before, having more beta testers increases the chance that there will be somebody in your group that will find any given bug transparent. And I had, on the FetchMail project, I had this happen to me innumerable times. People would send me patches for bugs I didn't even know existed yet. Okay? I mean, you've all seen this happen. Any of you who have coordinated a development, this is not a particularly unusual thing. But if you play this game right, if you do it the way Linus does it, you can raise this phenomenon to an unheard of level of intensity, to the point where all you're doing basically is sitting in the middle waiting for good stuff to come at you. And folding it into your master sources. Now, let's talk about the necessary preconditions for running a development this way. Having done it myself now, I don't think you can start a project in bizarre mode. Because there has to be a certain minimum level of completion and sort of design coherency in the code. It doesn't have to work perfectly. When you go public and start to run a project this way, the way I did in July 96, the code doesn't have to work perfectly, and it doesn't have to be incredibly beautiful, and it doesn't have to be documented. What it has to be is a plausible promise. Think about that. The one thing the code must not fail to do is convince a lot of people that with a foreseeable amount of work, it can be made wonderful. If your initial code nucleus doesn't do that, this method is not going to work. So you need a plausible promise. You need a code nucleus that people can look at and say, gee, that has neat possibilities. You need solid technical skills. As I said, it's not necessary to be a design genius. But it is necessary to be a competent coder. Otherwise, you're going to pile changes on top of changes, and the code's going to get really warty and nasty, and eventually it's going to collapse into rubble. But the most important thing you need, and I know this is a really novel concept for internet hackers, is people skills. Because in order to make this style of development work, you have to be able to charm people into doing a lot of work for you and feeling good about it. I have to say, I don't think it's a coincidence that Linus is a really nice guy who makes people want to help him, who makes people like him and want to help him. That's not a coincidence. It's also not a coincidence that I'm a natural extrovert with some of the instincts of a stand-up comic. In order to make this style work, you have to be able to relate to people, you have to be able to communicate with people, you have to, frightening thought though this might be to some of you, like people. Like people.
Like them.
So, I think this seeing that this style of development works in some way poses a challenge to all of us, because I'm beginning to think that solitary brilliance isn't going to be enough anymore. Because, what, somebody had a comment on that? Solitary brilliance is not going to be enough anymore, not because solitary brilliance is bad, it's wonderful, I like to practice it myself. But because the guy who uses only his own brain is always going to be overtaken by the guy who can use 400 other people's brains as well. Oh, and there's a point that I perhaps did not make sufficiently strongly, which is when I talked about Linus's law, all given enough eyeballs, all bugs are shallow. I want you to notice that not only is this a necessary condition for Linux to be successful, it is also a sufficient condition. In that, if it fails to be true, the Linux development cannot work. But if it is true, then that is a sufficient condition for Linux to be successful and stable and wonderful and give us all good feelings. So that was just a point I wanted to really reinforce there. It's a sufficient explanation. But back to people skills. Somebody have a question over here? Okay, no. Back to people skills. Yes. You have to treat your co-developers like you like them, otherwise they won't like you. This seems really simple and obvious, and when I see these things, everybody laughs. But let it be admitted that as a group, we hackers are not notably long on social skills. This is not the highest thing on the list of qualities you would automatically expect to find in an internet hacker. But now we have a good incentive to learn. So let me look for another bullet point here. I think I've covered the high spots at this point. And I have a bunch of maxims here like release early, release often, and listen to your customers. We can pass by that stuff. Oh, okay, now I'm going to speak heresy. I said that it's not really necessary to be a really brilliant original designer to make this method work. And the most powerful evidence that this is true is that Linus Torvalds is not one. Now I hear those shocked gasps rising from the audience. But if you think about it, Linus took his design from Unix. There is nothing really fundamentally innovative about the Linux kernel. I know this may come as a shock to a lot of you, but it's true. I mean, there are some cute tricks in the internals, there are some nice implementation strategies, but it doesn't break any ground as far as design goes. What Linus has actually is something which I think is less appreciated and less understood among hackers, but may actually be more valuable than design brilliance. And this is a sort of sixth sense for good engineering. What Linus is very good at is finding the development path which will avoid the maximum number of problems. You know, he has this amazing ability to just nimbly step past the yawning pits which the rest of us would fall into if we tried engineering something this complex. It's astonishing to watch, okay? Now I'm the other kind of hacker. I'm good at designing things, but I fall into those pits all the time. And so I actually think that Linus's expertise, this sort of engineering genius grasp of the least effort path, is actually probably more valuable than being a brilliant designer. Oh, God, I know I'm speaking heresy now, but I think it's true. So, let's talk about the future. What implications do we think this has for the future of free software and software in general? Well, I said earlier that one of the implications of this style is that in the end, whoever is able to coordinate the most brains looking at a problem is going to win. They're going to win the evolutionary race. Well, I'd like to point out to all of you that we as a community can throw an order of magnitude more brains at any given problem than any commercial outfit in existence. You can draw your own conclusions from that. And let's see, do we have any more major bullet points here? Oh, yes, I want to talk about ego and about gift cultures. It's pretty obvious that most of what hackers do, they are not doing for money. So what is it that motivates hackers? Well, I talked about Linus getting everybody's ego involved in a project by doing rapid releases and reinforcing people when they do good things or send features or bug fixes or things like that. What I want to point out is that although we don't tend to think about it much, the whole hacker culture works that way. What people are playing for is reputation. Okay, you have it's a commonplace in the hacker culture that you can't take the title of hacker for yourself. It's a way that other people describe you. It's a way that other people say that you have a certain kind of reputation for producing good, clever code. And I want to put this in context by saying that anthropologists have observed that there are several different ways that cultures can organize passing around value within the culture. We live in what is primarily, not entirely, but primarily a market culture in which people pass around valuable things in exchange for other valuable things. That is characteristic of cultures which have... which are not entirely coercive. They're not entirely based on who is the biggest club, but they're dealing with scarcity economics. There are scarce resources that they have to allocate in a market, so people get into all kinds of market competition to do those things. But there's another kind of culture that anthropologists occasionally observe, which is what you get in conditions of extreme material abundance, where there basically aren't any significant scarcities. So people don't play scarcity and market games. Instead, they do what they form what anthropologists call a gift culture. In a gift culture, you gain status. Everybody plays for reputation, and you gain status by giving things away. Okay? The classical example that may be familiar to some of you. Maybe not here in Germany, but some of you English speakers, especially from America, will know about Northwest Coast Indians in what's now Washington and Oregon, where their major form of social display was a big party called a potlatch, at which your host would call a whole bunch of people together and throw them a feast and give them gifts. Why did he do this? To gain status. In that culture, you gain status by giving people lots of generous gifts and giving away things. Well, when I came across the concept of a gift culture in anthropology, I said, wow, this sounds familiar. This is how the internet works. What you have is thousands and thousands of people who are giving their time away in huge chunks, giving their creativity away in huge chunks. And why are they doing it? To look good in front of other hackers. Now, if you think about it, if you're honest with yourself, you'll realize that's what's going on out there. And once you realize that people are playing this game basically for reputation, it becomes a lot more obvious exactly how you motivate people to work with you. In effect, you have to make a contract. You have to persuade them that it's a good bet that if they work with you, their reputation will go up. They will gain knowledge and skills and standing among other hackers. And it's because the way I like to put it is there's a term in economics. Economists talk about efficient markets in which making good decisions about how to spend your resources are rewarded very quickly. And there's another concept from a very different field. I'm a science fiction fan. And I go to science fiction conventions, and in that culture, it's understood that people do things basically to look good for other science fiction fans and to improve their own self-image. And in science fiction fandom, we talk about ego boo, which is what you get when your ego's been boosted. And I put these things together, and I realized that what Linus has shown us how to do is create an efficient market in ego boo. Nobody laughed, so I guess you didn't get it. But go away and think about that for a while, because it's a pretty powerful concept. Study economics if you have to. That's a good idea for other reasons, too. So that's what I wanted you to think about, and I'll finish that particular thread by quoting an anarchist named Kropotkin. Let me find my quote here. Here we go. Where is it? I lost my quote. Here we go. Kropotkin was a Russian noble who turned into an anarchist. And this is a quote which explains why he did. He wrote sometime in the mid-19th century, "Having been brought up in a serf owner's family, I entered active life, like all young men of my time, with a great deal of confidence in the necessity of commanding, ordering, scolding, punishing, and the like. But when, at an early stage, I had to manage serious enterprises and to deal with free men, and when each mistake would lead at once to heavy consequences, I began to appreciate the difference between acting on the principle of command and discipline and acting on the principle of common understanding. The former works admirably in a military parade, but it is worth nothing where real life is concerned, and the aim can be achieved only through the severe effort of many converging wills." The severe effort of many converging wills. Isn't that an interesting phrase? The severe effort of many converging wills. Well, that's the free software culture, isn't it?
Yeah.
And what Kropotkin is pointing out is that command relationships and orders can only take you so far, and they don't really work very well for any kind of creative endeavor or anything that demands intelligence. So, and a conspicuous feature of the internet is that it's very, very difficult to coerce or punish anyone over a TCP/IP link. So, what the internet has forced us to do, and what Linus has shown us how to take advantage of, it's forced us to discover how to take advantage of anarchy. How to organize and cooperate without coercion, without force. And the thought I'd like to leave you with is that ought to be the model for our future.